This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Back-to-Back Cafe, a worker-owned collective featuring fair trade, shade-grown organic coffee, pastries, and vegetarian food. Back-to-Back Cafe is open Monday through Saturday and is located at 6th and East Burnside. More information at 503-233-1929.
As debates over immigration legislation have continued in Congress, millions of people have taken to the streets to show support for immigrant rights. There were mass mobilizations and school walkouts across the country in April, and May 1st was the culmination of tremendous grassroots energy to make immigrants' presence and demands for rights unignorable.
All over the country, millions of immigrants and allies marched in the streets, and millions more supported an economic boycott by abstaining from shopping, working, and going to school. Drawing inspiration from the glimpse we've seen of the power that exists when we join together, we look deeper at the legislation, detentions, and repressions that have energized this movement. We'll be talking to Shakur Narayan of Hate Free Zone, a Seattle-based immigrant advocacy group. We'll also be talking with Chicano activist and writer Juan Santos and Leslie Radford, a Los Angeles-based independent journalist. Stay tuned.
My name is Shankar Narayan. I am Policy Director at Hate Free Zone Washington. We are a civil rights and civil liberties organization that works on immigrant issues in Washington State. And around those issues, we do local, state, and national level advocacy. We also have an education program that works in the schools, a mobilization program that works on civic engagement for immigrant communities, and a direct services program that provides support to immigrant community members. Our advocacy model has really been a grassroots-up advocacy model, so even though we do a lot of advocacy in Washington, D.C., we try to make sure that that advocacy is informed by what's going on at the grassroots level. You know, one of the good things we've been able to do is build a very strong local coalition of organizations who agree that we really need comprehensive immigration reform, that you can't just look at one piece of this issue in order to fix it, because that kind of a fix is not sustainable. The coalition that we've built in Washington State agrees that what you need for a comprehensive fix are four elements. You need a mechanism that enables employers to hire legally the immigrant workers that they need and give those workers a real path to citizenship to enable them to take advantage of all of the rights that come with being a part of the society. You also need to facilitate family reunification by fixing our broken visa system. Now that the backlogs in our visa system are so bad that if you want to bring over a family member legally, in some cases it's just a ridiculously large number of years that it would take to bring them over. That's a very difficult thing for families who get separated. So we need to fix that and make that system understandable and workable. We also need to protect workers, regardless of their immigration status, from mistreatment by employers based on their immigration status. We've seen a lot of cases of unscrupulous employers taking advantage of their workers being undocumented and using that as an excuse not to provide them the benefits that they would provide to other workers. And then finally, I think we really need to make sure that everyone gets the due process of law that they deserve, and that civil rights aren't thrown out the window in the name of expediency. So we need a system that really speaks to preserving civil rights and civil liberties for everyone. And unfortunately, the sad truth is that none of the proposals that are in Congress right now, at least, really accomplishes all four of these pieces. You've seen you know, some of the debates in the House and Senate that have been unfolding over the last few months. The House ended up passing a really draconian immigration bill called the Sensenbrenner Bill that many listeners, I'm sure, are familiar with, which basically reflects more of the enforcement-only approach that has really failed America miserably over the last 10 years. We've tried this before, and it just doesn't work. In 1996, Congress tried to harshen immigration laws and broaden criminalization of immigrants in the hope that making the system more punitive and more harsh would encourage people to stick to the rules. And unfortunately, what it's done is criminalize large segments of generally law-abiding and hardworking folks who get caught up in the system. The Sensenbrenner bill basically poured more money into border enforcement and was very problematic in the areas of civil rights and civil liberties and due process. And then moving on to the Senate, what's been happening there is there have been some proposals that are more comprehensive, but unfortunately all of them also have elements which erode civil rights and civil liberties. For example, the Hagel-Martinez compromise bill, which was the last thing that both sides, the Republicans and the Democrats, were trying to get agreement on at the last minute during the last session of the Senate. That bill had some provision for legalization of undocumented workers. Basically, it was a tiered system depending on how long you've been here. If you've been here less than 2 years, then you would have to leave if you are undocumented without the prospect of returning. If you've been here more than 2 years, then there was a tiered system. So there was some provision for legalization. It did raise the visa caps, so there was some provision for family reunification as well. The problem with that piece was that they didn't go far enough to actually fix the procedural elements of the visa backlog. So it's not just the fact that there aren't enough visas, it's also the fact that there's just not enough manpower to actually process those visas. So even if you do raise the visa caps, you're still going to have a backlog if there just aren't individuals to try to process those visas. And finally, the Hagel-Martinez compromise also contained these civil rights and civil liberties compromises, including allowing state and local law enforcement to enforce immigration law, restricting or eliminating judicial review in some cases, expanding expedited removal, expanding grounds for indefinite detention and mandatory detention. And these are all things that Americans should be very concerned about. Every single one of these proposed bills, including those that have been characterized as pro-immigrant bills, would include these civil rights and civil liberties problematic provisions, including expansion of the aggravated felony definition, indefinite detention in some cases, an expansion of mandatory detention, and enforcement by state and local police. There's a lot of things that every American should be concerned about if these bills.
Because your group, I believe, was a response to September 11th and the hate crimes that were being committed against people due to skin color bias and ethnic bias. Can you talk about what kind of detentions have been happening since that time and with these current waves of INS raids?
There are a number of issues at play here. One thing to understand is that happened in 1996 is that Congress took the aggravated felony definition, which was created really to refer to the most serious and heinous crimes like murder and like rape. They took that aggravated felony definition and put it out of context in immigration so that now, after 1996, you had a situation where the meaning of aggravated felony in criminal law was very different from the meaning of aggravated felony for purposes of immigration. So increasingly minor transgressions, if you were an immigrant, could lead to your being classified as an aggravated felon. And unfortunately, once you are classified as an aggravated felon for immigration purposes, the harshest possible immigration consequences kick in. So you're really in trouble then because you are subject to mandatory detention and expedited removal in some cases, which entails basically removal from the country without a proper hearing before an actual court. That decision would be made by a low-level bureaucratic official. So you're really in trouble as an immigrant if this aggravated felony definition attaches to you. And what we've seen since 2001 is an expanded use of those aggravated felony provisions, which were already too broad after 1996, to try and set this dragnet. That's the kind of enforcement you see. And under all of these proposals, the definitions of aggravated felony would be broadened even further to include something as minor as document fraud. For example, you know, many undocumented workers have put down on an I-9 form in order to get a job a false Social Security number. Now, this would basically cause many, if not most, undocumented immigrants who are working to be classified as felons. And, in fact, would undermine the legalization provision of any proposal because most of those provisions say that you can't legalize if you fall into this aggravated felony classification. That's the answer to one part of your question. Another part of your question is the use of the immigration system as an enforcement tool where possible terrorist links are suspected. Now, I think an important thing for listeners to understand is that the immigration court system is not actually a court system. It is, in fact, an entirely administrative body, and it is really governed by a very amorphous set of regulations that don't have the same weight as, you know, your standards of evidence, for example, in federal court or in a state court even. You don't have the same barriers to evidence that you would have in a regular court of law. So the result becomes that an immigrant in immigration court can have all kinds of things thrown at them that would not otherwise be possible to bring up in a regular court of law. And sometimes they're not even able to actually confront the evidence against them. They don't even know what it is that they're being held for. Of course, the judge, the immigration judge, is also an employee of the Department of Homeland Security, so there are obvious questions there about how fair a process an immigrant would get. To take just one example of what's happened in the immigration court system, I'll take the case of Sheikh Ibrahim, who is a Somali community member, is very respected in the Somali community. His long record of public service and community involvement was apprehended by federal officials upon his return from a trip to Texas, and was taken into custody at the airport and has since then been in detention and apparently sometimes in solitary confinement as well. The charge officially was a minor immigration violation. Apparently, they went back and they looked at his application for permanent residency. Immigration attorneys often disagree on how to fill out some of the paperwork that goes into permanent residency applications. So it's not that difficult to actually find an answer that looks off and try and detain someone on the basis of that. But it seems clear that the purpose of the detention goes beyond, you know, whatever minor violation was in that application, and that he is suspected of something else that the authorities aren't telling. Basically, anybody who wasn't born in the United States could be subject to something like this based on some piece of immigration paperwork in their past. There's really nobody who could avoid it. Our immigration system is just that difficult to understand and that difficult to navigate. You know, you can always dig up something on someone if you want to get them. And so that's what we're concerned about. This has really put a pall of fear over the Somali community.
And how many other cases like his do you know of?
In the country, there are untold numbers. We are a coalition partner with Families for Freedom in New York, for example, and they have seen dozens of these cases in New York State alone where folks are going into detention based on, for example, the aggravated felony definition, and really don't have much recourse to a legal system to be able to figure out even what's going on, why this is happening to them. I don't have a hard number for you, but I know that it is a pervasive problem all over the country. Part of the problem is that there isn't really a large numerical constituency for detention issues in the same way there is for the legalization issue. And, you know, I think that's for obvious reasons. First of all, these communities are smaller, they're less empowered, And you're in detention, you can't get out and join a rally. It's hard to really get a tremendous amount of attention to these issues, and we're trying to educate the public about the nuances of this issue. But, you know, the unfortunate fact is that it is very technical, and it's hard to appreciate for the average layperson what expanding the small definition doesn't seem like a big deal to expand a single criminal definition, but the reality is that that expansion actually catches up a lot of immigrants in a dragnet, and we need to make the public more aware of that. There is definitely in the last few weeks an increasing enforcement, and this is acknowledged by the Department of Homeland Security, an increasing enforcement of workplace laws, so essentially tracking down employers that have hired illegal or undocumented workers and conducting raids at the workplaces of those employers and basically arresting everyone there. We've seen a wave of that across the country, and this has really put, again, a pall of fear over many communities, and in fact, in some communities, has caused the economy to suffer significantly. There are areas, for example, where the housing market is red hot, and employers, you know, lose a lot of money when their workers aren't showing up because of rumors of these raids. Of course, you know, the economy suffers, and everybody suffers as a result. The prevailing mythology would have it that there are other workers who are lined up to take these jobs. That's simply not the case. You know, there are very few people in America who bring up their kids to take backbreaking construction jobs or agricultural jobs. So the replacement workers just aren't there. That is the kind of enforcement that we've been seeing more of over the last few weeks. The timing of the workplace raids is certainly interesting because it comes in the context of rallies around the country by immigrants and their allies in really unprecedented numbers. April 10th was the day when I think a lot of people saw the sleeping giant that is the immigrant communities waking up and saying, here we are, we're in this country, we have these issues of family reunification, legalization, worker protection, civil rights, and liberties. We want you to take notice of us. The ICE raids really seem to have started up in earnest after that. There is definitely a question as to whether some of these ICE raids are not meant to have a chilling effect on this kind of political activity by immigrant communities. Really, this is not a partisan issue. There have been coalitions of very conservative lawmakers. And there isn't really a large numerical constituency for detention issues in the same way there is for the legalization issue. And, you know, I think that's for obvious reasons. First of all, it's these communities are smaller, they're less empowered, and you're in detention, you can't get out and join a rally. It's hard to really get a tremendous amount of attention to these issues, and we're trying to educate the public about the nuances of this issue. But, you know, the unfortunate fact is that it is very technical, and it's hard to appreciate for the average layperson what expanding the small definition doesn't seem like a big deal to expand a single criminal definition, but the reality is that that expansion actually catches up a lot of immigrants in a dragnet, and we need to make the public more aware of that. There is definitely in the last few weeks an increasing enforcement, and this is acknowledged by the Department of Homeland Security, an increasing enforcement of workplace laws, so essentially tracking down employers that have hired illegal or undocumented workers and conducting raids at the workplaces of those employers and basically arresting everyone there. We've seen a wave of that across the country, and this has really put, again, a pall of fear over many communities, and in fact, in some communities, has caused the economy to suffer significantly. There are areas, for example, where the housing market is red hot, and employers, you know, lose a lot of money when their workers aren't showing up because of rumors of these raids. Of course, you know, the economy suffers, and everybody suffers as a result. The prevailing mythology would have it that there are other workers who are lined up to take these jobs. That's simply not the case. You know, there are very few people in America who bring up their kids to take backbreaking construction jobs or agricultural jobs. So the replacement worker is just aren't there. That is the kind of enforcement that we've been seeing more of over the last few weeks. The timing of the workplace raids is certainly interesting because it comes in the context of rallies around the country by immigrants and their allies in really unprecedented numbers. April 10th was the day when I think a lot of people saw the sleeping giant that is the immigrant communities waking up and saying, here we are, we're in this country, we have these issues of family reunification, legalization, worker protection, civil rights, and liberties. We want you to take notice of us. The ICE raids really seem to have started up in earnest after that. There is definitely a question as to whether some of these ICE raids are not meant to have a chilling effect on this kind of political activity by immigrant communities. Really, this is not a partisan issue. There have been coalitions of very conservative lawmakers in Congress who have supported positive legislation with all four components of comprehensive immigration reform. And, you know, I think that it fits in perfectly with the conservative rubric that everyone gets due process of law, for example. You want people who are working hard and playing by the rules to be rewarded by that. You want your economy to be flourishing. I think that those are all things that, you know, the conservative base in this country can identify with and reasons that they should also be concerned about immigration reform. I would just encourage people to get involved in this issue. And in doing so, really wake up and look around them to see where America is going. I think on the one hand, you have this possibility that's being presented that America will become a country of walls, that we just build a big enough wall down on our border, we militarize it enough, we make the laws so draconian that the punishment far outstrips the crime in terms of proportionality, and we hope that things will magically work themselves out. On the other hand, we have the option of really looking at where America is going in terms of who we are as a community, how do we treat people, how are we going to be a place where if you work hard, you're productive, you're the company will be rewarded for that, and how do you take that if you put people get the best of the business status, the output, the best of the business.
walking all by myself. No one walking.
Yo, you're tuned into KBOO Radio, and we're having a technical opportunity. So we're working with that, and we are giving you some happy music. And then very soon, we're going to go back to our discussion of global fascism and how the current U.S. immigration debate plays into that. So you should definitely stay tuned. This is KBOO.
Oh, baby, my love for you. Jackie Hunter, you're in the corner. Don't go nowhere. And I don't care. All your kisses weren't waiting for me. Daddy, daddy, daddy. I don't stay out late. Don't care to go. I'm home about 8. Me and my radio, babe. Hey, Miss Mahaney, saving all my love for you.
Folks, I think we're getting it, and Circle A's coming up again, right where we left it.
Our immigration status, but we'll also ensure civil rights and civil liberties for them, as we do for other members of our society. I think people really need to look at this as the new frontier of the civil rights movement, and to understand that this, much like the grassroots movements that happened in the 60s, around that civil rights movement, this is another community waking up to demand and to request that America give them their rightful place at the table.
We've been talking with Shakur Narayan. This is Juan Santos, a writer from Los Angeles.
I'm a member of the Aslan Mexican Nation Harmony Circle. We are a warrior society and native tradition. It's a group of tribal people along with Chicanos who are not aware of what tribe they came from, but who are of course native. And I am the editor of the newspaper of the Aslan Mexican Nation, which is called Mexica Tlatoli.
Can you talk to us about the political and psychological implications of casting the U.S. as an immigrant nation instead of a colonial nation?
Well, you know, I was just reading some notes from a white woman who has done a lot of writing around the struggle around immigration over the course of the last year, and she did some research. You know, you hear people say things like, we're Americans, and we have to have loyalty to this country. An American is a person who basically is Anglo or in the origins, or somebody who through their loyalty and their patriotism is loyal to the American system. They'll say things like that any further immigration of aliens, which say non-Americans, has to be prevented. And those are fairly common things, and they don't seem extreme. They seem like part of the mainstream discourse. Well, listen to what the writer Leslie Radford dug up on this. A Reich citizen is that subject who is of German or related blood only, and through his behavior demonstrates that he is ready and able to faithfully serve the German people and the Reich. Any further immigration of non-Germans must be prevented. We demand that all non-Germans who have entered Germany since August 2, 1914 shall be compelled to leave the Reich immediately. The U.S. is very much on a road to fascism, and fascism requires a scapegoat. Basically, the underlying message of the May 1st Gran Paro, the boycott, is that we will not go quietly, that we will resist. And there are going to be millions of the people in the streets declaring that today. To answer your question more directly, people say that we're a nation of immigrants and a nation of laws, and that is simply not true. The original Europeans in what is now and for now the United States were not immigrants. They were colonists. And the U.S. is not a nation of immigrants. It is a white colonial settler state. A white colonial settler state means nations like South Africa under apartheid, the former Rhodesia, Australia, Israel, where people have invaded other people's lands. Primarily Europeans have invaded the lands of peoples of color, taken those nations over, settled there, and made the original inhabitants second-class citizens. The United States is like South Africa under apartheid or Rhodesia, Australia, or Israel, in that it is a nation of colonists that is run by race laws, in which people of color are second-class citizens and always have been. And the overthrow, if you want to call it that, of Jim Crow didn't change that equation one bit. They replaced Jim Crow in terms of what they're doing to the black nation within this country by mass incarceration. So that whereas in the early 1960s, the average imprisonment rate of black people was the same as their percentage of the population, now it has skyrocketed. And there are millions of black people who are either in prison or going to prison and so on. Also, you see that, for example, they live under apartheid-style, ghettoization. Likewise, in Mexico, which is a nation of Indian people, the average Mexican is 80% Native American, was conquered in a racist war of aggression by the United States. And I was stunned when I did this research and found this. It was actually a debate as to whether or not to take all of Mexico and put Mexicans on reservations, as they did with our sister and brother Native people here in the United States and Canada, or whether to only take the northern part of Mexico, which is to say, get as much of Mexico as they could get, with as few Mexicans as they could get. And that was the choice that they took. Then you see things like the Chinese Exclusion Act, which barred immigration of people from China specifically, and the act claimed that the coming of Chinese laborers to the country endangered good order. Very much the same kind of rhetoric that you hear today from the xenophobes. So every single group that the United States has sought to eliminate or exclude has been people of color. Entry was allowed to people of European descent. Specifically, under the law, you had to be declared a free white person in order to be eligible for citizenship up until the 1950s. There were many, many Supreme Court cases that determined who actually was free and white. Some people made the grade, some people didn't. They say it's a nation of immigrants. That's not exactly true. The people who were allowed to enter were people who could become part of and integrate themselves to and assimilate themselves to a white colonial settler state. It is as if South Africa had allowed in whites, but not browns or blacks or yellows or reds or what have you, because they would believe that those people of white European descent would reinforce the system of apartheid. That's exactly how it operated here until 1952. Now, that's been loosened somewhat in the meantime, and of course it's become a huge, huge battleground exactly because of that, because they consider that other people aren't fit for citizenship. It's the same kind of rhetoric you've heard from colonialists, colonists all over the world. It's not a racial subtext. The denigration of people of color has been part and parcel of colonial systems everywhere. And so, oddly, those of us who are of Native descent are now called aliens, even illegal aliens, when in fact the reality is that if you want to talk about illegal occupation of land, the possession of by the United States of Native American land and of the northern half of Mexico, which is, of course, also Native land, is illegal. Under international law, conquest of land and territory and the absorption of that land is illegal. It is illegal to wage wars of aggression in that way and to seize land. So any person from the colonial nation that carried out that act is an illegal alien on land that is not rightfully part of their nation. So if you want to call me an illegal alien, let's establish our terms before we begin to talk about that.
Speaking of terms, apartheid is one of the terms that you brought up several times, and that's something that I think people don't commonly associate with the United States. Can you talk about the definition of that word, what it actually means, and how it does apply to the United States?
Well, you know, I believe that apartheid is a Dutch word, and Dutch is closely associated to German and thus to English. Apartheid means apart, the process of separation. And so that is the same kind of system that was used in the United States under Jim Crow. You had separate facilities, apart facilities, apartheid. You had, you still have, for that matter, virtually exclusively black ghettos, virtually exclusive brown barrios, virtually exclusive red reservations. In fact, the reservation system, which was called the Bantustan system in South Africa, was modeled on the system of reservations here in the United States, and so were many of the race laws there, modeled after Jim Crow and such. So it was very much the same thing. You know, I mean, it was very common for people of color to be lynched. There were signs in the state where I grew up that said no dogs or Mexicans allowed. It was illegal to speak Spanish in the school. It was actually a crime, not just a school rule, but a crime to speak Spanish on the school campus. You know, this kind of thing destroyed the lives of millions of people of color in this nation, and is something that, for those of you in the younger generation, you won't remember. I was born the year that the Civil Rights Movement started, so I don't remember all of it either, but I remember the Black Power Movement of the 60s and so on very clearly. And the correlation between what occurred in South Africa and what has occurred in the United States and elsewhere where there's been a white colonial settler state are strikingly parallel. You see the same thing today in Israel.
And while we're drawing parallels in history, can you talk about the parallels between the civil rights movement of the 60s in the United States and the civil rights movement that's coming up right now based on, well, first with opposition to 4437, which has grown much broader?
Well, okay, in terms of opposition to 4437, I mean, let's contextualize this for a minute, because we have to look at not only 4437, but the other laws that are being proposed. And the Republican Party now says that they have 60 or 70 senators behind a bill that is called the Hagel-Martinez Compromise. And under that compromise, everybody who's been here for 5 years or longer would have a ticket to stay. People who've been here for, I think, up to 2 years would have to go through a process where they have to cross back across the border, which, of course, will be impossible for the people among the million Filipinos who are here, the Chinese, the Brits, and so on, to go back across the border and then wait to be let back in through some legal process. And then the rest, another 2 or 3 million, would be subject to deportation immediately. Now, 4437, its most outrageous feature is that it would make people without papers, primarily brown-skinned people, felons, and immediately deportable. One thing it would also do is to empower police departments across the country to enforce federal immigration law. Effectively, then, immigration would become a kind of a new war on drugs, where millions of people of color would be arrested and terrorized and stigmatized, and anyone walking down the street who didn't have the right accent or the right skin color would become a target. That is one of the greatest dangers of this law, and one of the reasons that it points so dramatically in the direction of fascism. As I said earlier, fascism needs a scapegoat, and immigrants are rapidly on the way to becoming the equivalent of the Jews in Nazi Germany. These compromise laws are not as horrible as 4437. Nonetheless, there still might be as many as 7 million people subject to deportation. Everybody would still be made guilty of a misdemeanor instead of a felony. And the impact is the same, because you're still subject to arrest by police. And that unleashing of terror in the communities is what is most important, and what people have to understand, that unleashing of mass repression in our communities. And so in that context, the parallels between the history of African Americans and the civil rights movement, and for that matter, perhaps more importantly, the Black Power movement, and what's happening today are very important. Obviously, this is kind of a situation in reverse, where black people were struggling to overthrow the Jim Crow laws and the remnants of its enforcement. We are trying to prevent a law from being imposed upon us. And so there's, the time frames are different. You know, there's not 12 years or 15 years to build steam up for it. It has to happen within a matter of a week. It's amazing that it has. There is a kind of slow death that's being suffered right now in the impoverished African-American communities, and it is a specific thing that occurred in the wake of the civil rights movement, and it's very, very important that we not allow ourselves in the immigrant rights movement to be divided in using the same tricks that the powers that be used to end the Black Power movement. First of all, they used open repression, murdered many, many activists, especially Black Panthers, and there's a carrot and stick involved. The carrot and stick that they used to bring a cooling out period, if you want to call it that, to black struggle, was that the government, when they imposed or instituted, I should say, really, affirmative action, were basically in the business of creating a black middle class out of nowhere. And they did that through government jobs, by and large, and through greater access to education and what have you. What resulted was that a certain amount of black people came to have an investment in the system because they became middle class rather than poor. And they are seen by the powers that be as being kind of a buffer cast between the system and the blacks who got left out of that process, who they did not assimilate, who they did not offer justice in any form, and who might rebel. And so there was a kind of divide and conquer mentality about what happened. And we're facing the same kind of trick. They want to offer legalization to 5 million people and perhaps deport as many as 7 million in mass raids. They're basically trying to buy off a section of the migrant population, hope that they will not support the ones who are left in the status of quote-unquote illegality, and they'll be able to carry out their ethnic cleansing against that sector of the people and make the rest of them loyal to the system.
We've been talking with Juan Santos.
You're listening to Circle A Radio, KBOO 90.7 FM.
Our leadership here in Oregon, particularly Ramon Ramirez of PECUN, which is the largest Latino organization in the state, is calling for a full legalization of the 12 million plus undocumented people who live in this country. But I have been hearing a lot of people supporting the compromise, saying that it's not realistic to go with something other than the compromise, that we're just preserving the status quo and that's the best we can do. What do you say to those people?
Well, I mean, you know, I'm walking a little bit dangerous ground here to make the direct comparison to Nazi Germany, because we're not in the immediate sense talking about death camps, although we are talking about detention camps. But, I mean, would it have been realistic to say that, well, okay, let's cut a deal with Nazis to let 5 million Jews loose and 7 million Jews be subject to whatever penalty? No, that's not realism. What seems real to people is based on their understanding of history. And as Malcolm X said, for example, if you don't know your history, you don't know who you are. And so people are operating under a series of illusions. And these are the same people who are saying, don't boycott because it might bring a repression down on your head. What they're failing to understand completely is that the repression is not something that people of color or women have ever brought upon themselves. No woman who is beaten by her husband brings it on herself. There is a psychosis, there is a sexist psychosis, there is a racist psychosis that has its own internal logic that drives itself, that causes this kind of persecution. In this case, let's call it a colonial mindset. And, you know, nobody provoked the mass raids last week. In fact, they were part of a plan. They were part of a plan called Endgame. Endgame was a plan devised by Homeland Security and what is now called ICE, La Migra, used to be the INS, the Immigration Naturalization Service. Of course, this is under the Bush administration. This plan was drawn up. Their plan is to deport every deportable migrant without papers by the year 2012, 7 years from now, or 6 years from now. That's their plan. It's not going to change because we wear white shirts and wave American flags. That's their plan. The thing that has caused them to back up and back off has not been the white flag of, yes, white flags and white shirts, the surrender, you know, the passivity, the paws up and belly up approach. It has been rather the potential that they see for mass resistance. What the boycott is about is a signal of our willingness to resist the kinds of trouble that might follow if the white colonial settler state decides that it wants to continue en masse its persecution of other rightful caretakers of this land.
So you would say to those people, get out in the streets and resist.
Yes, absolutely. And I would also call upon white people and brown people and Asian people to understand the hour and understand that if they're able to get by with this, if they're able to get by with mass raids and mass deportations and mass terror in the barrios, that that is a signal, a fateful signal of a turn toward fascism, especially for the Asian community. I mean, there are 1 million Filipino immigrants alone without papers. Nobody's talking about them. There are hundreds of thousands of Koreans. There are hundreds of thousands of Africans. You know, this is not just a brown question, and everybody has an investment in this. We just came from a meeting with the Nation of Islam, which, of course, put together the Million Man March, a Million More March, where they mobilized women, and another march that involved some million people. They're the only people who've been able to mobilize those kind of numbers outside of ourselves. And we have their full backing. They understand that we can't allow this kind of divide and conquer to happen. And I would hope that for white progressives, for white people on the white left of whatever stripe, whether they're anarchists or Marxists or social democrats or liberal democrats for that matter, will understand that this is a divide and conquer trick, that this is a scapegoating trick, and that people will not buy or sell their labor, will not buy or sell anything that day, and will come out in the streets with us and come out en masse. One of the things that has been marginally disappointing here in Los Angeles is that there has not been a visible mass turnout of the white left here. Now, I qualify that because we have a million people marching. The 10 or 12 or 20,000 people who turn out for anti-war demonstrations could easily get lost in that crowd. But I want to call on people of all nationalities to turn out in support of the migrants, to turn out against fascism, and to understand exactly what hour it is and what is at stake. We're either signaling that we resist or we're signaling that we surrender, and that's happening tomorrow.
There is the Nazi parable that they were demanding the abolition of a regular army and the construction of a people, a Volksarmee, a people's army, which makes me think a lot of the Minutemen and what's happening now, saying we can't control our own borders, so the people are going to start to form armies of their own.
Exactly. The Minutemen have called for the deployment of the National Guard on the border, as they've done in Arizona now. And people like Chris Simcox, who is one of the two primary Minutemen leaders, has actually called for the unleashing of the National Guard within the barrios, to clean out the barrios, right, to round people up en masse, put us under martial law. And so there's those parallels. There's, there's even things like Nazi policy declared openly that if citizens of Germany could not earn a decent living or feed themselves, then non-citizens, aliens, as they call them there, have to be expelled from the Reich. So, yeah, it is very chilling.
Can we talk a little bit about what deportations actually look like, that maybe people aren't going to be hit across the face with large roundups, but that people begin to disappear slowly from their communities?
Yeah, that's one of the things, you know, is like in the African American, you've basically had a mass roundup where you have extraordinary numbers of people who are either in jail, on probation, or on parole. It's in the millions in a very small community, relatively speaking. And those people have been arrested and incarcerated on a one-by-one basis. If the police are authorized to enforce immigration law, if each one of them were to arrest an immigrant once every 3 months, within 5 or 6 years, every single undocumented person in this country would be gone. They don't have to do it in mass raids. They can do it very, very quietly. And just as you see that the ghetto has become a place where the police function as night riders, and they've always, in the ghetto and the barrio, operated as an occupation army, there's an atmosphere of terror and of extreme violence and despair in many of America's ghettos. It is not the same atmosphere as exists in the barrios. That will come to pass. If people are disappearing, if there's no mass resistance, if there's the kind of silence that there is around the mass incarceration of African Americans, then fascism will have been successful. By the same token, let me give you a sense of what an actual lockdown on a community looks like, because I've been present in one in a Mexican and Central American area called the Gulfton District. The police and the INS at that time, now ICE, locked down the neighborhood, and they actually put up concrete barriers and wooden barriers, and mothers would disappear going to the grocery store for milk, and the kids would be left home crying, hungry, frightened. The father would come home later in the afternoon, and the wife is gone. In fact, that kind of scenario just happened here in Los Angeles, where a sheriff from the L.A. County Sheriff's Department decided that he was going to turn three women into La Migra, and did so. They disappeared. You saw a photograph in the newspaper of her husband, one of the women's husbands, with a four-year-old girl on his lap, you know, heartbroken. It means the destruction of families. There are families here who have a quote-unquote legal right to be here on the part of the wife, but not on the part of the husband, and vice versa. The children are legal U.S. citizens. The parents are not. And honestly, it is very hard to predict what's going to happen, whether it's going to be the mass destruction of the Mexican and Central American family, and the Native American family, because there are a lot of, especially here in Los Angeles, there are a lot of Mayan people who fled the genocide in Guatemala in the 80s and 90s. It is very unclear whether those families are going to be broken up or whether it's going to happen like it happened in the 1920s and 30s and again in 1950s under Operation Wetback, where people were deported wholesale of red-brown skin, where virtually as many Chicanos were deported as there were Mexicans and people of other nationalities. It's very hard to predict what's going to happen, but it is not hard to predict that it will create an atmosphere of terror in our neighborhoods, and that is part of the same racist psychosis of persecution and occupation that has basically guided the history of this nation.
Can you talk a little bit about the proposed detention beds?
That is coming under the current administration, and under the current administration's budget. It's coming from President Bush, who has endeavored to paint himself as a moderate in this whole scenario. It was very frightening for a while because, honestly, it looked like the Bush position was the liberal position on the matter, right? Mm-hmm. Not that I think liberalism is worth a damn, but that was a very frightening scenario when we knew that Bush's plan was for mass incarceration and mass deportations, along with whatever he decided to, whoever he decided to legalize. That has remained consistent. Whether you're talking about H.R. 4437 or any other bills, two things that are really consistent are increasing the capacity for incarceration and the beef up of border security, including either a literal physical fence or a virtual fence.
So, Juan Santos, what is the potential for a transformative movement that does take into account U.S. imperialism and the colonialism that this nation is founded on?
Well, you know, some of us have been talking about that here, and there's the potential developing for what V.I. Lenin called, I believe the term he used was hot mix. Hot mix is where an insurrectionary situation develops because many different streams of struggle come together at once in a situation in which people have lost their awe of the state and of its power, and in which the powers that be are divided among themselves about how to move forward, and it's, they can't rule in the old way. And if you see the potentials, for example, the widespread disenchantment with the Republican Party, and of course the absolute disenchantment with the president, the disgust, the calls for impeachment, the potentials for nuclear war against Iran, the, of course, ongoing horror of the colonial occupation of Iraq, and the very fierce and brave resistance that's being waged against that. There are so many fronts upon which these streams of struggle could come together, and the more outrageous the actions of the state are, the more probable it is that it's going to happen. But again, you know, anything, any kind of mass movement or resistance is built one step at a time. It's just like if you're going up a ladder, if one of the rungs of the ladder is faulty and breaks under you, you don't get up. And the crucial juncture, of course, is May 1st. If we can't resist, then we won't be able to resist later. Let me be very clear and speak to you for a moment from an indigenous perspective. As Gloria Antaldúa reminded us, this land was Indian land, it is Indian land, and it will again be Indian and Mexican land. And that is not because of some imagined reconquest, but it's because of natural flow events. And the people who have seized this land have abused it to the extent that it's dying. That is because the culture that has seized it doesn't respect itself and doesn't respect what it's stolen. This land, here in the Southwest in particular, speaking as a Mexican person, was our grandmother's land, and now it's a prison where they want to lock us up. But the reality is that no matter what happens short of genocide, eventually this will again be native land.
We've been talking with Juan Santos. This is Leslie Radford, a teacher, journalist, and anti-fascist organizer from Los Angeles.
Hegel Martinez would allow 5 million people to apply for citizenship. The question that I, as I understand it, in Mexican, Guatemalan, Salvadoran, Honduran communities, it was a question of timing as much as anything. I think there are some folks in those communities who want to go for the compromise. From my point of view, that compromise is a bad compromise. That leaves 7 million people without citizenship. Say of those 5 million, 3 million manage to jump through all the hoops, pay their back taxes, prove they've had steady employment, pass all the requirements for citizenship, and pay the $2,000 per person fine. Say 3 million manage that. That's 3 million that have citizenship. Now, of the 7 million who weren't eligible, they all have to go back to their home countries. And the plan under Hegel-Martinez is to issue somewhat less than 500,000 work visas per year and some family visas. We send 7 million back. We let 500,000 wage earners in per year. It means you bring over the wage earner, and he or she brings over their family, but no other adult in that brought over can work because they don't have a work permit.
Mm-hmm.
So they become one-income households on low wages. It's not a good program. Mass deportation on a slightly smaller scale.
The article that you wrote, The Conscience of a Nazi, really, really struck everybody here who read it. You know, people really aren't willing to say the F word about the way our country is headed.
My primary focus in my activism is anti-fascism. And as I say in the article, I think most people recognize there's a trend toward fascism in several aspects here. And what I discovered is that people were not hooking the immigration problem into the obvious parallel of Nazi Germany. I open with a quote from Claudia Kuhn, and she writes of a Nazi youth leader who watches his friend being marched off to the death camps. And the youth said that a few years earlier he would have denounced the roundup, but he had been so indoctrinated by that time that his thought, when he saw his friend being hauled away, is how unfortunate that his friend was a Jew. And I begin to see that mentality creeping around here. You know, how unfortunate that that person doesn't have papers. They're going to have to go away. And I began looking back and forth between German law and our laws today. And the parallels are stunning. Perhaps the one that struck me most was the definition of a German citizen. Is a German citizen is a person who is German by blood. How much closer can we get to having an all-European nation? And that's my concern. You know, the objection to the immigrants in this country is largely based on ethnicity, and there's no way around it. There's no way that it can be explained any other way. We may let, as I just got done explaining, it looks like maybe 3 million people may get citizenship out of this, maybe less. But that leaves this a clearly European nation, European-American, with our neighbors just to the south being excluded from the culture and from the life here, much as Jewish people were defined out of German citizenship. I looked at the use of the police, local law enforcement in Germany, and they were given the responsibility for rounding up Jews and delivering them to the detention centers, just as H.R. 4437 and, in fact, every other proposal that's viable, that may pass through the Senate, actually funds local police to round up people without papers and deliver them over to the Border Patrol or Immigrations and Customs Enforcement. In fact, the laws pretty much turn police into bounty hunters. They get reimbursement from the federal government for processing people out of the country. That's every incentive in the world for local police departments to start roundups, to start just grabbing people in the middle of the night and taking them away. Under Hegel-Martinez, the compromise, and the rest of the propositions, people can be detained indefinitely in detention camps. This is not a grab them and release them in Tijuana situation. They can be held incommunicado in detention camps for unlimited periods of time. Now, that's a roundup. That's disappearing people. And that's what we're talking about as I read Hegel-Martinez. One of Halliburton's subsidiaries has a big old contract from the federal government to build more detention centers. They're looking right now at 10,000 more beds in the short term. To be a citizen of the German Reich, you had to demonstrate behavior that you are ready and able to faithfully serve the German people and the Reich, and I am quoting there. In H.R. 4437, we're talking about making anybody who aids or abets an immigrant a criminal. Now, that may be modified slightly so that they won't be felons, but they will be misdemeanors. But they're still criminalized. They're still subject to jail time, to fines, for putting water in the desert, for buying lunch for a friend, for giving a ride, for housing somebody who doesn't have papers. And again, we've got families pitted against families. You have somebody, a cousin, who's got papers. They put you up. You don't have papers. Both of you become criminals under the system. And they're talking about building 700 miles more border wall. Well, right now, we have about 66 miles of border wall. And since it went in 94, 4,000 people have died trying to get around it. And somehow, Senate, the House, people in this country seem to think that, okay, we build 10 times more wall, that's a good thing. No, that's 10 times more people dying in the desert. This is fascism. This is repression. This is finding a scapegoat community to blame for the ills of our society, and you already hear it. Immigrants are responsible for failure of our education system, the failure of our health system. They're responsible for tuberculosis. They're responsible for the plague. They're responsible for everything that they deem wrong with the society. And that's what scapegoating immigrants, scapegoating migrants does. It takes the responsibility off the government. They're free to do whatever they want because whatever problems they come up with, they can blame on the migrant population. And that's how fascism works.
This just kind of came flooding back to me in reading your piece. I, a few years back, went to the National Holocaust Museum in D.C., mm-hmm. and a lot of art and popular cultural work,
wow.
theater pieces, music, cartoons, scapegoating Jews, and, you know, likewise with the Chinese Exclusion Act in the United States. You know, you think of those drawings of Chinese people and the Japanese when they were during World War II. The popular culture, the popular media, really creating a mass culture of intolerance.
You know, there's a new video game out called Border Patrol, and it's exactly what you think. You earn points for shooting migrants, and they blow up, and you get extra points for shooting pregnant women. I follow what the Minutemen are up to, both inland here in California and on the border. They're real happy with the idea of criminalizing migrants. And I'll tell you why. They don't care if it's a felony or a misdemeanor, by the way. That's not the issue. They're looking forward to being able to do citizens' arrest. And they can do that if these people are committing a misdemeanor. And the Minutemen have every intention, both inland and on the border, of grabbing people and turning them over to immigration. They talk about it fairly openly. That's the plan. As long as they can get some level of criminality against them, we're going to see private citizens running around rounding up folks for us.
Leslie, can you talk about what the hallmarks of a fascist society are?
I think most people of a leftist bent recognize that there are three things happening for sure. Corporatism, the takeover of the government by corporate interests. Imperialism, extending the reach of government to other nations, other sovereign nations, and repression of thought, of speech. The fourth piece that made Nazi Germany work, scapegoating, the idea that some other entity is to blame for whatever problems come up, is key to making fascism work. There are four elements to a fascist state: corporatism, imperialism, repression, and finally scapegoating. And I think most people acknowledge the first three. I'm hoping that they will start recognizing that the fourth piece to a fascist state is in play right now. We're going to make that determination in the next few months, whether we are going to legitimize scapegoating. And right now, it's sort of a cultural taboo in most quarters, I think, to blame a group of people based on race or ethnicity for social ills. But if we, in fact, make these folks criminals, then that legitimizes.